My area of particular responsibility is Reformation, church history, and theology. I'm also an ordained pastor in the ELCA. This is my second week here, and I don't think you'll have any trouble following today on because you weren't here last week. But one of the projects I sort of gave people was looking at Christianity as a call to people to kind of to try on an identity and to pick out some key sort of descriptors. We talked about what it is to define ourselves, identify ourselves as priests, as forgiven sinners, with the emphasis on the forgiven, as Christ's table companions. And today I would like us to think of ourselves preeminently as creatures of God. I'm going to start small. As you can judge from, my area of expertise, I am have not a great deal of wisdom to impart in the area of ecology, or conservation, or scientific matters. But I do think that even in the small arenas of our family and personal lives, the way we define ourselves and think of ourselves can have a great deal of influence about how we are present in the world and what kinds of questions we take up. I mean, it's very interesting sometimes to look at what are the things you don't see or don't worry about because you kind of defined yourself within a certain arena and that one is not central. And then to try on those things and say, well, what kind of person would you be if you did worry about this a great deal? I'm going to start by reading you I'm an inveterate magazine reader. I sometimes find this more helpful than much of the material I read in my own field. I am not a person who reads magazines to go to sleep. And I think the questions that we find there are often very challenging ones. This is from the July 29th New Yorker. It is a review of a book by a Yale historian on the city of Chicago. His name is William Cronin, Nature's Metropolis, Chicago and the Great West. It's getting reviewed all over everywhere, so without doubt you'll encounter it. But a very interesting study of the rise of Chicago in the 19th century and what he calls first and second nature, and how indeed that city was intimately involved with the countryside or the natural surrounding where it grew, and vice versa. It has been seen then as a way of telling history, taking account of a dynamic that often is not viewed. But I found this passage particularly striking in a description of Chicago and the developments in that century. Consider the most notorious emblem of Chicago in the late 19th century, the meatpacking plants. No visitor could help being impressed by their ghastly efficiency. The bravado of the packing business was caught perfectly by an American tourist, a natural booster who stood before some scenic wonder in New Zealand and told his guide, quote, "Well, I guess, stranger, you would reckon it a grander sight to see a man standing to his waist in blood-sticking pigs. We do that in my country," unquote. When Frederick Law Olmsted visited a hog packing plant in Cincinnati, he and his party were so struck by the speed with which men butchered hogs that, quote, "We took out our watches and counted 35 seconds from the moment when one hog touched the table until the next occupied its place," unquote. But other visitors found the packing plants fascinating for a different reason. Rudyard Kipling wrote, "They were so excessively alive, these pigs, and then they were so excessively dead. And the man in the dripping, clammy, hot passage did not seem to care. And ere the blood of such an one had ceased to foam on the floor, such another and four friends with him had shrieked and died," unquote. Olmsted describes the machine, Kipling the victims of the machine. Cronin, who's the author of the book being reviewed, reminds us that in the world of first nature, and first nature for him is the non-human world of ecological relations, describes it, that in first nature we are close enough kin to the hog to mourn his passing before we eat him. But in the city, at the end of what came to be called the disassembly line, the whole hog was less valuable than his parts, every one of which found a commercial use. The result was the utter abstraction of the hog or steer from nature and the utter separation of meat from slaughter. Cronin writes, In the Packer's world, it was easy not to remember that eating was a moral act inextricably bound to killing. The sheer variety of these new standardized uses for every part of the animal testified to the Packer's ingenuity in their war on waste. But in them, the animal also died a second death, severed from the form in which it had lived, severed from the act that had killed it. It vanished from human memory as one of nature's creatures. Its ties to the earth receded, and in forgetting the animal's life, one also forgot the grasses and the prairie skies and the departed bison herds of a landscape that seemed more and more remote in space and time. The world of the marketplace, where city and country met, was and remains a world of such forgetting. The farther a hog or a white pine log or a bushel of grain was taken from nature, the more its value seemed to arise from the effort that human beings expended in bringing it to market. Cronin discounts this familiar theory of value. Nature is present in so many forms in his book that it finally comes as a shock to realize that for Cronin, nature is already a thing of great inherent value, which belongs in an important sense to itself, and of which human beings are merely an inalienable part. This is what many believe, but few have read in a scholarly work of history. By the logic of nature, not the logic of capital or the logic of the frontier, the settlement of America and the rise of its great cities look less like an opera of self-reliance than like a colossal burglary. A sizable share of the new city's wealth, Cronin concludes, was the wealth of nature stolen, consumed, and converted to human ends. The review, by the way, is written by Verlin Klinkenborg, a memorable name, who wrote a very interesting book a few years ago. He's written others since then, but a book on haying, H-A-Y-I-N-G, about the whole process bringing in a crop. So he's a person, I think, eminently qualified to review this book with a sensitivity to this dynamic of history. Then the other piece that I came upon is in some ways a satire, but this is in Harper's for August, and it is the idea that we need to set aside a new national holiday, and they are suggesting Blushing Monday, the first Monday in August, a day set aside to revel in shame. And their argument here is, from time to time, civilization demands the creation of a new holiday to celebrate a mystery or call humanity to some new self-awareness. We need a new holiday today because we need to be reminded that the great works of humanity, the very best that we do, entail a heavy cost not only to ourselves, but also to the world we inhabit. As a species, we cringe at the thought of the price we pay to live in civilization. We kill animals for food. We raise forests to provide shelter and print our books. Our thirst drains rivers. Our waste create dreary landfills. Our cars and factories darken the air. Our very existence depends on the loss of other species, extinct or never allowed to evolve. As individuals, our freedom is achieved at the cost of other people's choices, our personhood at the cost of our parents' plans and sacrifices. We are creative and loving only in the shadow of our own embarrassing childhoods, of our accepted shame. Because in our minds we have uncoupled the costs implicit in human activities from the resulting benefits, we have become a nation divided into two kinds of unpleasant people. Scolds who in an eternal search for moral purity sourly demand suffering and guilt, and debauchers who scorn any accounting that interferes with their pillaging. Without acknowledging the heavy price we pay, we cannot truly enjoy the rewards, and without enjoying the rewards, we cannot truly lament the cost. Now, as it goes on, they provide everything from a Hallmark greeting card for the season and a delightful first message from President George Bush in celebration of the day. It is a painful piece of satire at points, but I think what they're outlining there at the beginning is indeed very much part of the human dilemma. These are obviously not scholarly journals from the religious realm. They are not the things I get brownie points at home for reading. But I think what's important is these are the questions that occupy, I mean, these are popular journals, namely, these are the questions that are occupying so many people. And if we as a community of faith don't have something to say to it, they're probably not very interested in what we have to say at all. I mean, that's what is troubling the world. Then if our message is of meaning, it is of meaning precisely to those issues. I think it points out what is the real dilemma we face. And in one sense, it is our forgetting. We are a tradition that tells stories, that repeats them again and again, generation to generation, so that we preserve a memory without which we do not know who we are. And one of the really poignant things in that piece about the Chicago slaughterhouses is that in the process of a generation or two, that the distance became that great, how fragile a thing our memory is of who we are and how we were connected. It's even pointed out there that at the beginning, you know, in the 19th century, the grain that you bought still came in the sacks from the farmer who did everything until it was his grain he was selling. Later on, what you have is, it's bought up, it's poured into silos with how many other sets of grain, that the farmer himself, his family, would be disconnected from the fruits of their labor. I mean, speculating in commodities is bargaining on things that haven't even happened yet, you know, crops that haven't come in. So that I think there's a part, too, to bemoan, to feel some pity for ourselves. I mean, we talk about all the dislocations we face in the world. This is a revolutionary dislocation that happened rather abruptly. Again, I'm not a great historian of the period, but judging from the history of Chicago, you could say in two generations. And so who we are, how we understand ourselves, and having been then cut away from our involvement, our part in this whole web of natural relationships, it breeds a kind of forgetfulness and carelessness. In addition, there is, I think, always the denial of the cost of life, the cost of all life. The natural order is not all lightness and beauty, and particularly the cost of human life to one another, to the world in which we live. One place, and heaven knows, to recover memory, I would not want to recover the statistics of women dying in childbirth. But up through the last century, one can say the cost of the most elemental of natural acts and human being was very high. You know, we don't even know that. Those of you who maybe had the sorrow of losing a child or bearing a child who suffered in the birth process some kind of impairment, whatever, realize that you feel quite lonely these days because it doesn't seem to be a standard part of people's experience in our part of the world. And let me say, in many communities within our own country, it still is. But we don't have that kind of common memory then of the cost of life, and that the things that we walk into, where I live, it's Rainbow Foods, Cub Foods, I guess, is national. Pick those things, to know what it means to have that kind of abundance. And until you go into that store with somebody from a part of the world where they don't have it and watch their jaws just drop. I was in the big store in Minneapolis one day where some of the students from the American Field Service, you know, had just moved in with their families and they brought them for their first grocery shopping, and they just stood in the produce department sort of like, you know, at what was there. That we eat things that aren't even in season where we live. You know, this is something that's unheard of for many people. So then in this identifying of who we are and telling of our stories, I think it's important that we recover that connectedness that is still an integral part of the experience of many people in the world, and that we have lost much more recently than many of us imagine. So, having said that, my sense at least of where the problem lies, how we could begin to address it, and I realize that doesn't take up any of the technological questions, what wisdom or help can we derive from our tradition that has its theological wellsprings in the 16th century and before? First of all, I think we have to do some historic justice and to say that for the forebears in the tradition, many of us come out, I'm not going to assume that everyone here is Lutheran, but you've heard of it, and probably are formed yourselves by traditions that went through some massive identity crisis in the 16th century, that this experience that we have was foreign to them. Not that the New Yorker was being published then or even its equivalent, but I don't think this is the kind of article you would have read if you had something like that. So we have to look at the questions, the traumas that they had, which doesn't mean that they're indifferent to the questions that we ask. But even when you read like the letters and things of Luther, his connections with his family, what he relates of his family life, these are people still tied very closely to the earth in many ways. I mean, what his wife really wanted to do was buy some more property so she could plant. And when she was able to get it, she ran quite an operation. They brewed their own beer. When they had tons of people staying at their house, which they often did, they really had to be concerned how they would feed them. And one of the important things that Luther got in terms of payment and that was guaranteed to his wife when he died, in terms, was commodities in that way, that there'd be food on the table. So the sense, I think, remember, Wittenberg, the city in which he taught, had been newly founded. It was a little mud hole, you know. I mean, the sense of what you mean, that nature had the upper hand in many parts of Europe at that time. I think we, you know, need to remember that, that I don't think he could have begun to have dreamed of what we would be able to do and the threat we would represent. Indeed, the Copernican Revolution, which is going on, I mean, Luther himself was sort of indifferent to that, you know, I mean, any sense of how we fit in the soul, in the universe and all this out there. So, I mean, in some sense, one has to recall that what we may see as a serious limitation is also the fact they were given a different challenge. They lived in a different time. Indeed, many thinkers have judged that the Reformation and particular Luther's approach have actually aggravated the problem, if not being a sort of a root of the kind of abuse that the natural order has suffered at our hands. Luther has been praised, of course, by some for having secularized the world, as it's put, having let the world stand on its own terms. Remember that, again, Luther's concern was largely with human relationships, with the political community, and with his sense that the medieval church had indeed come to the point of interfering and manipulating the world in ways that were inappropriate, sort of dividing it up into a spiritual state, a higher way to live, and then the rest of the people, that there was something not so good about just being in the world on its own terms. And Luther's response was to say, all Christians are called to be priests. There are manifold vocations they can serve. None is better than another. So the guy who's looking after hogs, the woman who is brewing beer, is called to a place that's honorable in the eyes of God to serve the neighbor and give glory to the Creator. So in that way, it's freeing the world to be the world with all the possibilities it holds, along with its dangers, and saying to people the gifts that God has put in creatures of reason, of affection, of will, are ones that serve them well in the affairs of this world. And thus, it is not quite right for the church, you know, to sort of say, I'm going to preempt that, but to give it its due. And this, in a Trinitarian doctrine of God that understands God as a creator, God's already encountered in the world. God is there. So Luther talked about a left-hand reign of God, as he put it, a right-hand reign of God. They sometimes call it the two kingdoms, which I think is not so helpful because it's sort of spatial, and it's not a question of space, but to say how God affects, comes among us in the proclamation of the gospel, in the writing of the relationship of human beings with God, the forgiveness of sin, is one way that God makes God's self known. But that this left-hand realm, as they call it, and it's even bad because we have, you know, bad connotations about what's left and what's right. Of course, if you're left-handed, you don't. But that God also rules through God's law. Now, this is a difficult subject because what exactly is that? We generally reduce it to moral law, and there's even some debate over what that would include or not include. But a sense of God's ordering and sustaining presence throughout the creation that is as essential for our existence, really, as is God's proclamation of forgiveness through Jesus Christ. And so it seems to me that if, on the one hand, this sort of freeing up of the world, as Luther allowed it through this sort of saying, it's its own realm, you know. People are called to service here, and it's not to be confused with the church's realm of grace and forgiveness. They're not to be collapsed. The church can't claim this as its place to dictate and rule. Also, of course, leaves it open to what's going to kind of put the brakes on humans who remain sinful running riot. Here is where, if on one hand the law, God's law, is seen as the thing that condemns us, you know, they taught that you hear the law that convicts you of your inability to meet the righteousness of God and will drive you to the mercy of Christ because you know you can't do it yourself. That's not a positive experience of the law, most people. But the first use of it, as Luther puts it, is indeed a very gracious presence of God among us in the law, ordering, sustaining, protecting what God has made, and indeed serving most often amongst human beings to restrain them, to restrain the wickedness that they would perpetrate, to preserve what is good, and to protect the weak. Now, obviously the greatest concern in the 16th century was with relations to human beings, but it seems to me it's quite possible to extend this to say, well, who is weak in relationship to you and me? We're laughing like we had a bear here last night, maybe you've heard, who was trundling around up by the chalets, and we were laughing at the little parade we made as every time the bear made a circle, somebody else joined until it was the bear leading 10 or 12 people. And under certain circumstances, indeed, we would say that the bear was stronger. But this sense of what needs to be protected because it is pleasing in God's sight, I think is then an insight in the teaching of our tradition that can be very helpful. As long as we begin, you know, this hearing, so often we just dismiss the law as the thing that makes you feel rotten and guilty. See? It's also that, but it also works to sustain life. Even with the Lutheran doctrine of sin, which indeed sees the damage as deep, pervasive, and enduring, that baptism does not remove the brokenness of our nature. We struggle with it all our lives. The insistence was that the creation in all its parts is good. And thus, there's no way to be dismissive of it. You know, I mean, almost like children sometimes. Everything's such, you know, this toy's a little bit broken, or this isn't right, I don't want it anymore. Or it doesn't matter what I do to it. You build something up and tear it apart. You know, that it has not lost its luster in God's eyes. And neither have we. If we look then to our doctrine of creation as most foundational, it seems to me also that the doctrine of redemption must be extended in our understanding of its importance for the whole of God's world. The 16th century was clearly concerned with the issue of human sin. How is sin forgiven? How is grace received? But remember, it was not that one would then live in stasis, but rather that one was redeemed to live in the world in productive, in peaceful, in God-fearing ways. How did we come to that position? Well, the focal point then was really on understanding how forgiveness is mediated to the human community, and how we then write our relationship, or should I say, God writes the relationship that we have with God. I think now we have a far greater sense than probably did our forebears of the dangers that our sinfulness represents. I mean, in terms of the extent of what we can do. We have tasted the wonder of our powers and as I say, the perils of them. We have that marvelous passage in Paul's letter to the Romans about the groaning of the creation that is itself in bondage, waiting for the liberation of the children of God. If we remember then that the human fall into sin represents not just a human tragedy, but has precipitated an ecological crisis, then the doctrine of redemption in Christ has far-reaching implications well beyond the boundaries of the part of God's creation we know best, and that's us, our problems and involvement in it. It seems to me this is a place where the theology of Eastern Orthodoxy is often even more fruitful. A sense for the Orthodox that the real damage of sin is the allowing into the created realm of a principle of dissolution and chaos. So that even when people repent of their sins and are forgiven, it doesn't stop, see, the demise. One feels this so much in reading the Psalms, where the fear is that what God has ordered will dissolve back into chaos and be lost. Thus, the emphasis in much of Orthodox theology on the incarnation itself is that by the entrance of the Savior into the realm of finitude, and I think here we think particularly, well, Jesus was human like we're human, but one could also say Jesus knows what it is to be a finite being dependent on a natural order. And thus, the experience of earthly life for the Savior has ramifications not just for humans, but for all of these finite beings that live in dependence on a natural order. And that we look at his death and can say that it's not just human death, but all that comes to be and perishes is embraced in this redemptive act of the Lord. That death itself, once it has been touched by him, is co-opted in a way, taken back for God's purposes, no longer allowed to be the force of destruction in the world. So those are, I'm going to leave it open for some questions. Then I would say, how does one begin? I mean, you know, it's fine to sit and sort of speculate in this way. How do you begin? I mean, to recover that sense, to build the identity. And in simple ways, I mean, I think they grow. I certainly wouldn't discourage people from taking the big steps, but I know that's often hard. I mean, I was reading, they do exposés in Harper's too, and showed them, it's just awful that the Audubon Society ran an advertisement in the Direct Mail trade magazine offering their mailing list. Do you know how many millions of trees are destroyed every year in direct mail appeals that we never open? And the Audubon Society proudly listed the general income of people who belong to the Audubon Society, the age, what kinds of stuff they're going to buy. All upscale, and you're sort of like, ooh. You know, I mean, it's living with the fact that we will never be pure. And I think that also the realistic recognition that the mystery of God we encounter in the natural order is that life comes at the expense of life. There are things we do that lay waste and are destructive, and there are other times where we do sacrifice the life of things that we may live. To do that with a reverence and a mindfulness is important. And to distinguish between me, as one of my friends said, you know, the only reason I'm a vegetarian is because carrots can't scream. They are living things. And I studied with a cooking teacher, and I remember, at the time I thought, oh, come on, you know, don't throw your vegetables in the little Oscar and annihilate them, you know. She said, there are ways of, you know, just taking a carrot or something and preparing it for consumption, that in some ways is an act of community. You know, we're all sitting there going, and I thought, but there's something to it. And those of you who cook, who know when you set aside the time, when you grow your own vegetables, you know, do that, that you're mindful of something giving itself up that you might live. Of the sacrifices that you are called to make, in teaching, in the rearing of children, in the loving of a spouse, in fidelity to your friends. And the beginning of that kind of sense of reverence, of necessary sacrifices and of violent, you know, deprivations of life that are uncalled for. So I think something is that the other thing, this cooking teacher just read an article for us recently, who's talking about baking bread. In fact, Deanne and I were laughing about this. She said, when you bake bread, you should set aside a whole day and just do that. Well, we live lives, see, just like the kind of lives of the people in those meatpacking plants. 35 seconds and the next hog is on the table. That a deliberate discipline of stopping some of that, I think to begin to penetrate at the levels where you live every day, I think helps people then to gain a vision for the wider issues. And to care about things that you don't experience immediately, but you have an analogous experience, to know what it is to lose something natural that is of importance to you, so that a country that suddenly can't grow something that they lived with for years, or an animal that's exterminated, that it's a loss. And to accept some of the losses will be necessary, that to think of ourselves too, we're part of this evolutionary process. I mean, I think what we have. Then finally, it seems to me we must be careful about idealizing nature, as I've hinted at before, or humanizing it. That often in the most idealizing sort of descriptions we give, you see us sort of trying to paint into that world the best of what we'd like to be. And to recognize that it, as this review said, it's complete in itself. It is unto itself. It's known to God. In ways that we cannot know it, and there's a point at which we have to respect the unknown in it. Its maskedness, just as frankly we have to accept that in God. We don't like it much there either. And thus, to recognize amidst the wonder of this world in which we live, there is much that is fearsome and cruel, and some of it is natural. And here, too, we come up against the mystery of God's working and must at points fall back and ponder. So that to me, that struggle to do justice to the natural world, not to turn it into paradise, we've not been called back to Eden, but at the same time to honor its own being. And to recognize that before God, I mean, this is, to me, the extension of the doctrine of redemption is so important. It's not just us that God is after, but it is through us, some very important ways, that God is working for the life and wholeness of the creation. So let me stop there and leave it open to questions or comments. You know, there's some people here who've done more work with these issues than I, so I certainly appreciate their... Yes, please.
Well, I haven't done a lot of work. I need to, but I liked your reading about the hog and the 35 seconds and then the day for baking bread. I just finished reading a book called Plain and Simple, and it's about a woman who went to live with the Amish a couple of times because she wanted some order and some... to see what, you know, she was trying to get away from the busyness of her life and trying to find out what was about them that was seemed to be so peaceful. And that came out, the fact that we hurry through our sweeping and our dish doing, and the act of actually doing it in itself should be not the end of the, you know, you should participate fully in doing it, not just rushing through it. And that sort of thing.
I think this is the kind of place where you can begin. I mean, as people say, how do you begin to build a spiritual life, a kind of spirituality, you know? Well, I don't know, but I remember reading a wonderful novel about somebody who'd gotten in trouble and this priest was being meant to work on his spiritual life, and they gave him a passage of scripture to read, and he was a scholar, you know? And he said his spiritual director would come back, and he'd be like, "Well, I'm done. What do I do now?" He said, "I want you to read that passage for 35 minutes, not for four." You know, and not being able to do that. So I think sometimes, you know, when people say sit and pray and meditate, you just, you know, because But how can you take up, indeed, the tasks you do have before you for the maintenance of? And this is, seems to me, a place where the doctrine of vocation can be a very fruitful one. That they themselves, in a kind to that centeredness, a kind of mindfulness, a thought of the implications, an offering to God of the task itself, you know, thanksgiving for it, that can begin to change that. I mean, I read another piece. They're trying to find out ways to make microwave French fries. I mean, because this will make a bundle. But as we all know, microwaves make everything soggy. So this has been rather hard to get. But you just think, good God, don't we have better things to do? You know, and the Heinz, apparently the Heinz Company has failed in 57 ways, as they put it. But I mean, it's those sorts of things that, what we eat and how we eat it and what it means indeed to understand that there's that sacramental quality to being fed. So what you choose to eat and whom you choose to eat with are really reverential acts. And I mean, I know sometimes a lot of somebody said, you've been out in California too long. And I think, let me say, I started practicing yoga when I was in graduate school because I was afraid I would have a nervous breakdown. That is probably one of the most labor-intensive sort of things, and not a reverential act at many points. And I was stunned at how just paying attention to something like where I put my arm, as my yoga teacher would say, you grew that arm. Now, it's your responsibility, and it's not supposed to be where it is. You know, would just change that. And I mean, and that led me from that to worrying about what I ate to beginning to work with somebody. But, you know, and I'm just saying that they are kind of incremental things. But to create sort of that spirit of thanksgiving, I think, is really important. And what it did was help open my eyes to things in the tradition in which I grew up that I think I just didn't really see before. Yeah.
I think dancers have much the same, at least a few dancers I've known, dancers have much the same sort of approach or insight or something. They've gotten it, they start with the body and somehow it pervades their lives.
Mm-hmm.
As an attitude.
And they're the kinds, you know, who will see an animal or something and comment on the way its muscles move or the things that it can do that a human, you know, in comparison to human anatomy. Notice so that it, yeah, it can extend as well. Yeah, that's a good point, though. They, I don't know, other.
One of the questions that I have is that when you talk about this and live with the kinds of consequences of that redemption of creation piece that you're talking about, is that one of the things that what I constantly hear in my work is people not having the choice, or not believing that they have a choice, that they must do this or must do that, because of the society, because of the pressures, because of the consequences coming from Oregon, logging, the issues around logging and extinction of species and things, come in some very interesting conflicts because people don't see the choice. People take certain jobs because they don't believe they have a choice, that if they don't take this job, they will not feed their children. Is, at times, that having that choice is, seems to be an extra benefit that we share because we can afford to be here, you know, in time, in space, and things like that. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with that feeling of the lack of choice that some people have?
Well, I think that it's not just a feeling. I mean, I think there are people who don't have choices, that we can look upon ourselves. I mean, that's, I was thinking a comment that a colleague, a woman I met who teaches at St. Olaf, made one time about her students who were very worried about they're coming near graduation and whether they would go here to graduate school or do this or do that. And she said, I feel for them in their quandary, but I pointed out to them that they're very lucky to have choices, that many people in the world don't have any choices to make. So that's the place where I have to say, especially those issues around employment, you know, I mean, those are the hard ones we make, at what cost it will be, because they do fall disproportionately on some people. That's what it'll mean. They won't work. Yeah, Kelly.
Yeah, I'm sitting somewhat cynical. I'm thinking about the example of the slaughterhouse. We're all the animal for about 37 seconds. And we do certain things to prolong our time on the table before we're replaced. We follow our culture, technology, and science in order that we might have a little longer time than the person behind us. I think we're not very far behind the way that we treat all creation.
So that in some ways we're as much victims as victimizers.
Definitely.
Yeah.
That's the way we experience ourselves. But as Mike said, we do have options, we have choices, but we're not told that by the popular culture or by our religious experiences.
Well, I think Kelly's right to a certain extent. Maybe our religious experiences don't tell us that there's something else, but maybe that's precisely what we need to say, what our religious belief needs to say to us is that despite the fact that it feels like you have 35 seconds, that's not all there is to be said about you. And that just as our tradition has the potential to help us to see all of creation in a sacramental light because of Christ's redeeming action, that doesn't mean we forget that each of us is also redeemed. And that 35 seconds is not the last word. It's not the last word about me, and it's not the last word about the world in which I live. Otherwise, it's so easy to just give in to despair. There was a woman here earlier in the summer who was talking about some of these issues, and that was precisely the thing she kept coming back to. She said, you know, I work with lots of secular people who are concerned about the environment, and they're all very energetic and earnest, but by and large they are without hope.
I never pronounce her name right, but Mercy Oduya, who's an African Christian theologian, and a piece that she did, I mean, I think we were saying about that maybe one of the things we need to look at is that indeed, I mean, we do die, I mean, and we die in many ways over the course of a lifetime, and that to be sacrificed, in some sense, is our destiny. But she made a very interesting distinction in an article I read of hers where she talked about the difference between being sacrificed. I mean, you know, that somebody else decides what they're going to offer you up for, and yourself, self-sacrificial. And you may actually end up going the route they want, but you have in some seen your path there and what costs you will pay to what ends. And that I think that there is a way in which it's sort of, I mean, one of the hard things for us is we want to think we're really very different. And we are a lot like the natural order in that we have our season and we pass away. But there are, I think, some differences in that. Again, I'm not strong in animal husbandry, but I was recently reading this fiery book by a Roman Catholic theologian from Germany, who was very critical of the Roman Catholic Church's stance on issues sexual over time, and traces back into the early generations of the church, even where they held up as an example of continence to human beings, elephants, who never have intercourse when they're carrying their young. And her point was, very rarely have animals been held up as sort of models for human behavior. But when it comes to things, you know, I said, they at least have the good taste and the moral fiber to know that you only do this so that you'll have a baby. And once you have one, you stop. And recognizing that one of the, it seems to me that, you know, that it's ironic that they couldn't just turn that around and say, one of the wonders of human beings is that they aren't just instinctual, but indeed they can take this very aspect and use it as the creation of intimacy and expression of love, and also in destructive and cruel ways. I mean, you know, and elephants can't sexually abuse one another, I don't think. Again, as I say, I'm not, because this would be an interesting tape on it. Let's speculate about that. About your average depraved elephant. But that kind of sense of then these very natural things in which we are like the orders around us, nonetheless, we have a self-consciousness about them, a willing of them to use them in ways or to refrain from using them. And so we're kind of caught, I mean, as a hybrid, because I think you're quite right, Kelly. There are other ways in which we know, born into the world we are. I just think sometimes, I mean, of just having grown up in the kind of environment, there's things I just take for granted. And when I don't have them, I get very agitated like any animal put into an alien sort of environment, you know. I have loss of appetite, you know, sleep, I mean, all, because, and there are oftentimes very material things that I'm just used to having, or ways people would behave, things like that. And then I have to say to myself, look, you're not that in control. Whom are you kidding? And that's humbling. It's that. That's what I say. To think of ourselves as a creature is to recognize those kinds of limits, but to understand that it's all the difference. I have a friend of mine who is a great fan of dogs, and she pointed out. She said, you know, generally an animal eats until it's full and stops. I mean, they know that, and you don't go into the forest and see animals that have to go to Weight Watchers. You see some chipmunks around here who are having some problems. But why? Because of our presence and having altered sort of things that were there for them. So that there are other areas in which we do have a kind of a control. But the systems that we're born into, that's what I say. I think it is such an arena for kind of despair. And one of the things that in Lutheran theology, I did my doctoral research on Luther's eschatology. This is a big word to talk about the end times, how he thought the world would end, where it was going. And if one could say in contrast that the work of John Calvin really understood the Christian community, when the church begins as a light to go into the world and begin to restore the order of creation, Luther, I think, was much more pessimistic. That we're going to live in this kind of tension between being fallen and redeemed, and that the end will sort of burst in. That leaves you sometimes thinking, what do I do until that happens? What hope is there for improvement, for changing things? And I think one of our greatest enemy here, truthfully, is despair. There's got to be a way to recognize the reality you talk about, but despair is, to give up hope is to fail the first thing in our calling from God. That we must be a people of hope. And it's not easy.
Wasn't it Luther that said, though, if I knew the world was to end tomorrow,
exactly.
I'd still plant my apple tree?
That, as there are always Germans who will scout every page they can find, they don't think he really said, they have no verification that he actually said it, but because it is so appropriate to what he would have said, it has come down as one of the best known things that he didn't say. and maybe he did, you know, it's, who knows, it came along. But yes, exactly. I mean, and that really is a remarkable act of trust. And so you chip away where you can.
Worse.
Blaine, in that the sense of having secularized the world, many people felt was taken as license then, sort of to steamroll right over it. you know, that that some of the restraints or constraints that had been there earlier. And I, like I say, I think that that, one can see where that could happen in altered circumstances, but I also think there are some important elements, say, in the left-hand reign of God, the understanding of God's law, and the affirmation of the goodness of creation and human vocation as service that offset some sense of that being a license, you know. And as we know, I mean, the other side of it is indeed that ecclesiastical structures, I mean, when they often worked in very detrimental fashion, you know, in curbing or in interfering with, in places that were not for the health of the body, natural and politic. I don't know whether, Eric, if you don't want to say more, I don't know if somebody knows more about that aspect. I know that is one criticism that they raised. I mean, the whole connection actually with more Calvinist Protestantism, though, and the rise of capitalism and the work ethic and all that, and some of the negative heritage that has left us, and that the problem has been far worse in historically Protestant countries than it was in. But I say that's for Weber, that was connected far more with Calvinism, and that has been questioned as a fair reading. Because already at the time, you have to remember the Reformation in the 16th century, well, you have the beginning of kind of mercantile capitalism coming sooner than that. You know, I mean, that one of the problems in the whole period is this radical change where people didn't just live on land or have land, where suddenly they dealt in commodities and they had money, and that's already a kind of a distancing. And the society was having difficulties. How do you square that with something saying that, you know, scripture that says that money is the root of all evil? Or the whole question of taking of interest. You know, so it's already there.
Well, then you'd have to say it was already there far back, because didn't Plato raise issue, I forget, Spinozolongo, Aristotle, Plato, which one? That Plato, I believe, did not believe in the taking of interest. So it must have already been an issue for Plato, because he said, animals have babies, but money doesn't produce money. So how can you?
Because so it's unnatural.
Yeah, so it was an unnatural thing. And so this goes right back to the Greek city-state.
Yes, and one assumes that one finds that. Right, the problem is, of course, that when you're doing Western Europe, you have a somewhat of a decline from the height of you know, I mean, that coming out of it again, that for a while that was probably lost. But you're right, it's there. And Aristotelian philosophy, anyway, was very important for the work of Thomas Aquinas, who's one of the ones in the High Middle Ages who takes on this question of interest. And that's exactly it. It was seen as unnatural. So, yeah, please.
Well, Danny, you have a lot of thought-provoking statements in your introduction. And the one question, though, is why does nature need redemption? The Romans 8:19 talks about nature being in travail. Let's see, talk about that. But maybe you'd said earlier about the fall of Adam and Eve, how the impact that had on nature. But it seems like nature is being done too. You know. But the other part is that we are part of nature, the interrelatedness of all life and everything. But see, the way I have ideas and all, that sort of the crux to me is, if I understand something, is, well, how can I explain it to another person? And if someone asks me, why does nature need redemption? I don't know how to explain it. Are you even talking about that?
Yeah. Well, I think that one thing you have to kind of move away from, I mean, it's because we're part of the order. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's to say that if we're going to claim that we do, in some sense, all things that get caught or woven up with us are touched by what's amiss, and that's a little different from holding nature responsible in some sense for a moral failing. Right. I mean, see, there's where you, but remember, that to me, that is also the power of the insight in Orthodox theology, is that emphasis on this sort of slide into decay. I mean, the possibility of the world sort of, as God has ordered and structured it, sort of dissolving. And it needs in a sense, to be redeemed or rescued from that. That is a different category, as I understand it, from talking about, you know, moral failing and sin, but they're connected. And so that the burden of the damage or whatever is felt differently by different orders of the creature, but because you can't just separate them out, that in some ways the natural order has been both the victim and the instrument of our sin. It has, you know.